House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Thursday, March 17, 2011. We're going to go out of order. Today on the agenda, the first two bills we're going to hear combined 3211 and 3153. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3211. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3153. And I'd like to call the front is Representative Huffman.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, first, House Bill 3211 changes ORS 163095, which lists the circumstances which elevate a murder to an aggravated murder. Among these is the character of the victim. An aggravated murder presently occurs if the victim is killed in the course of their official duties and the victim is a police officer, correctional parole or probation officer, a member of OSP, a judicial officer, a juror or witness in a criminal proceeding, employee or an officer of a court of justice, or a member of the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. This bill would add the classification of reserve officer to be a factor that raises a murder to aggravated murder. House Bill 3153 similarly expands the definition of peace officer and police officer for purposes of the criminal code to include certified reserve officer and reserve officer. There are a number of crimes, furnishing false information, interfering with a police or peace officer, etc., which depend on that classification for eligibility.
Thank you. And Tom Adams and Mike Morgan can come up as well, please. Representative, please.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee. I appreciate the committee's time in hearing House Bill 3211. I know you're busy. Just a couple of bills pending before session ends, right? And so I appreciate
you. Representative, for the record.
Oh, John Huffman, State Rep for District 59. And with me are a couple of my constituents from Jefferson County. And this bill was actually suggested because of a situation that happened in Jefferson County. And I'm going to let them share, so I'm just going to stay quiet and turn it over to them. Thanks again.
Thank you, Representative.
Tom Adams, Chief of Police in Madras. Last year, in May of 2010, I had two full-time officers and a reserve officer shot at during a pursuit. It was only during the court process that I learned that there would be a difference in the way the criminal sanctions were handled as far as being full-time officer status or reserve officer status. Ask you to support a change in those criminal sanctions to so there wouldn't be a difference, that a reserve officer would be treated the same as a full-time officer. Reserve officers are crucial to accomplishing the department missions. They're vital. These are volunteers that selfishly give up their time and work for their communities, and when they're wearing a badge and a uniform, it should be recognized the same as a full-time officer. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
Well, I would be, as Mike Morgan, City Administrator from Madras, this is probably one of the highest priority legislative issues that the Council has endorsed this year. We certainly support Representative Huffman's effort to bring this before the committee and the legislature. We think it's a surprise to all of us to discover that we don't have an equalized status for a reserve under the law as we have regular officers. How critical is a reserve officer in Madras? We have 10 reserve officers that actively patrol the street and or ride along with regular officers. On the other hand, we have 8 regular officers. We have more reserve officers necessary to deliver public safety services in Madras than we have full-time regular officers. This is critical to the public safety of our community, and hence the reason we bring it before you. The Council recognizes two additional things. They felt that the reason the legislature must have this law in place is because it recognizes that an assault on a uniformed officer or the other special classifications listed in that law is an assault on society as a whole. And also we recognize, and I think the law does too, that people who do something like this are absolutely out of control. It's not a typical person-on-person crime. And if one followed the story specific to the events in Jefferson County and Madras with these two people, both of which have pleaded guilty and one of which has already been sentenced, it was clear that it wasn't going to end with the attack on these officers. Indeed, one of them was later captured in an actual shootout where he was wounded. So these are very bad people that find themselves in this situation. So Our city council pleads to the legislature that it consider equalizing the status of reserve under officers under the law. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there any questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next call, Bob Ball, Judy Stigler, and Patrick Singh.
I'll go ahead and start. Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, and members of the committee, my name is Captain Bob Ball, and I'm with the Portland Police Bureau Reserve Unit. I've served as a reserve officer in Portland for 15 years, and it has been an honor and a privilege for me to serve the citizens of Portland in this way. Recently, I chaired a work group on reserve police officer issues and brought together law enforcement stakeholders from throughout the state. This type of work group had never been convened until now, despite various bills regarding reserve officers coming to the legislature in the past 10 to 15 years. We knew that it would be important to bring together these stakeholders to move forward in a collaborative manner. Before I discuss the two bills, I'd like to share information about the Portland Police Reserve Unit. Like most other reserve programs around the state of Oregon, Portland Police Reserve officers are community members that are ordinary citizens who volunteer their time to serve their communities. We are teachers, mechanics, and yes, even legislative assistants. We receive no pay for the work that we do. We are motivated by a desire to help others and the love that we have for our city. Reserve officers go through the same selection process as a paid officer. After successfully completing this process, they spend hundreds of hours in an academy and post-academy training. They go through an extensive field training program and eventually work side by side with paid full-time officers. As you can see today, we also wear the same uniform. Our officers provide regular patrol support, make arrests, and enforce traffic laws. We work missions that range from drugs, prostitution, and car prowls. We help at large community events like parades and runs. We are there to help the men and women of the Portland Police Bureau to improve the quality of life in our community. In 1995, a law was passed that defined what a reserve officer is, and its passage had the unintended consequence of removing us from the definition of a peace officer. House Bill 3153 fixes this and protects the work of reserve officers under state law by adding them to various crimes against peace officers, including assaulting a peace officer, providing false information to a peace officer, and resisting arrest. The bill also gives reserve officers the ability to assist with nearby community festivals and parades and to cover officers in other jurisdictions when necessary. Portland Reserve officers have and still put themselves at risk by responding to cover other officers outside of our jurisdiction because they have had to make that decision that the safety of another police officer was more important than any jurisdictional issue. They have also had to make the same decision when it came to helping citizens. During a Seattle to Portland bike race, a bicyclist got hit in a head-on collision with a vehicle outside of our jurisdiction. Our reserve car was the closest to this incident, so they went anyway because potentially saving a life of a citizen was too important. House Bill 3153 stops our reserve officers from being put in this kind of a position. House Bill 3211 adds the murder of a reserve officer to the aggravated murder definition. Reserve officers face the same risks and dangers as other officers in uniform and need to be treated in the same way under Oregon law in these tragic events for the safety of the families involved and the community. You will hear more about this in later testimony. We are proud to come before you today with the unprecedented support of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon Associations of Chief of Police, the Oregon Peace Officers Association, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon District Attorney's Association, the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, and the Oregon Association of Reserve Police Officers. I'm also submitting a letter today in support of these two bills on behalf of my chief, Mike Reese of the Portland Police Bureau. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, Judy Stigler. And this bill was, House Bill 3153, which I'll speak to, was a bill that I had drafted and Co-Chair Barker agreed to submit for me or on my behalf. It came to me through a fellow in Central Oregon who is, he is a retired, I believe, Los Angeles police or area police officer, and he brought this issue to the attention of my husband, Mike Dugan, who was then the serving district attorney of Deschutes County, that the unintended consequences, as Mr. Ball has referred to, take reserve officer out of the definition of police officer under certain circumstances, even though they are out there doing the job and conducting themselves in a professional capacity, but they are not covered, and much of and some of the work that they do, there's a question, quite frankly, because the definition referenced in the statute doesn't specifically cover reserve officer. So what this measure was designed to do, and I did do some due diligence before going this further step, I asked some questions specifically in my local area, and I know that this particular fellow is currently a reserve officer in Central Oregon, I believe for the Sheriff's Office, if I'm not mistaken. His name is Don Swift, and I think he's going to be testifying later. He runs and administers the Central Oregon Reserve Academy program, which is modeled after the basic police course conducted by the DPSST. Local program has 425.5 hours of training conducted over an eight-month period of time. Upon graduation, the reserve officers return to their agency and under the supervision and training of the field training program for whatever agency that is. These officers are all officers that are sanctioned by their local or state police agency pursuant to current Oregon statute. This isn't outside anybody's parameters or outside any current existing area of law. And what this legislation, quite frankly, was designed to do was to correct what I perceived to be an unintended consequence of earlier legislative efforts, and that's why I brought this forward. So I commend it to you today. I think it's a good bill. I will speak to this. You'll note that Representative Huffman's bill covers aggravated murder. This bill, Section 4, also covers that. My understanding is there will be an amendment submitted that will take Section 4 out of this bill, out of House Bill 3153, so that the two issues are dealt with. The aggravated murder aspect is dealt with in a standalone bill, and then this will, House Bill 3153 will address the other underlying issues. So with that, be happy to take questions. Or
thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm a reserve police officer with the Portland Police Bureau. Some of you also know me as a legislative aide to Representative Gene Cowan, who represents House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. I'd like to thank you for taking time to hear these two bills. I believe they recognize the work that around 1,300 volunteer men and women across Oregon do, not only as volunteers, but also some as paid part-time officers as well. I'd like to thank Captain Ball and former Representative Stigler on their leadership with these bills and for leading recent work group meetings that have brought various stakeholders together. I've done some research regarding past sessions, and this has been an unprecedented collaborative effort, as Captain Ball mentioned. I began my law enforcement interests as a Kaiser police cadet when I was 19 and in college. Served in that capacity for 2 years and realized there was a huge benefit to community policing, not only in the city of Kaiser, but also throughout Oregon. During that time, I was also appointed by the mayor of Kaiser to serve on the city's community policing committee. And so through those experiences, I have a personal commitment and interest in making sure that we have enhanced policing community within our neighborhoods across Oregon. For the past 2 years, I've been a reserve with the Portland Police Bureau. I attended a six-month regional academy
through the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and have also completed 1 year of our 18-month field training program. During this time, I've received extensive training in criminal law, patrol procedures, defensive tactics, and firearms training. I have also been tased, and if you don't believe me, please visit my Facebook page. Our goal is to support various police departments and sheriff's office around the state, but what I've learned in my short time being a reserve is that while we are working out on the street, that citizens do not distinguish between paid and volunteer officers. As Captain Ball mentioned, we wear the same uniform, we drive the same car, we have the same equipment, and our work is in the support role, but oftentimes those two kind of mesh. I can let you know that also my family does not distinguish the difference, and if a tragic event were to happen, I'm sure that they would want the same type of justice served as any other police officer that I served with. And I'm proud to have my wife, Christy, here, and also my parents visiting from Arizona also. As Captain Ball mentioned, we carry the same equipment, as I mentioned, wear the same uniform, drive the same police cars, and that's why we need these two bills, 3211 and 3153. These bills provide the protections we need while we are on duty. And as Representative Stigler mentioned, there is a pending amendment to delete Section 4 from House Bill 3153 that we'll get to soon. This language adds reserves to the definition of aggravated murder, as mentioned. Representative Huffman and the representatives from the City of Madras, as well as Kevin Campbell from the Chiefs Association, have done a fantastic job of gaining support for that particular bill, so we'd like to have both issues move on their own merits. And again, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and the three of us would be happy to take any questions.
Any questions, Representative Shaw?
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. These are great concepts. I'm grateful you brought them forward. You got my full support. I was, you're right, Patrick, everybody out there protecting us from the bad guys that city manager referred to need to be treated equally. But I was reading the paper today, and there was an article about an officer who was shot and just sent home after being a week in a hospital. And for just a moment, I was startled because his name is Patrick Singh. And so I'm glad. I hope he keeps well. I'm grateful to see you're here, healthy. I knew it wasn't you, but just for a moment there, I was like, "Well, wait a second. No, I just saw him." Anyway,
Co-chair,
your diligent work, and thanks for coming.
Co-chairs and Representative Schaffler, the day that shooting happened, his name's Parik Singh.
We do get
mixed up. My phone did ring a little bit more than usual that particular day.
Patrick, you said that you were unpaid, and I'm glad you clarified because I thought you were double dipping today.
Co-chair.
That would be Officer Lady because he just retired. Oh, no, you're not retired yet.
And thank you for your service, both of you. And while frequently we think of reserves as helping in the small towns, in a department as big as Portland, your services are vital there, and I've known that for many years of experience there. And that just being able to count on the reserves during the Rose Festival parade, during the runs, during the presidential visits, there aren't enough regular officers to do the job. Thank you again for your service.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, I'll call Bill Miller, Corey. I might read that. It looks like Medeiros. And Don Swift. Somebody else handed me the notes. It wasn't somebody's bad. Your bad writing. Please go ahead and in the order, identify yourself for the record.
Co-Chair Barker and Kruger and committee. I'm Bill Miller. I'm a member of the Umatilla County Sheriff's Office out of Pendleton. I've been a reserve deputy for the past 30 years. And prior to that, I was a reserve deputy here in Marion County for 12 years. I'm here to promote House Bill 3153 and 3211 and explain how they pertain to reserve police officers. Today, I'm also representing Oregon Police Officers Association's 1,200-plus members, and I represent ORPO, Oregon Association of Reserve Police Officers. I'm currently president of ORPO. ORPO is a subchapter of OPOA, and we have about 100 members representing 29 agencies throughout the state. There are almost 1,300 reserves in the state of Oregon. They work for both the small rural department and the largest agencies in the state. Reserves complement the regular paid officers of these agencies. In some smaller departments, reserves are often the only source of backup and relief for days off or vacation. Reserves usually wear the same badge and uniform as regular officers, so the public can't tell the difference as a reserve officer performs the duties of a police officer to ensure the safety of the cities and counties.
Okay.
In Umatilla County, we have 8 regular deputies and 18 reserves. 8 of these reserves are solo reserves and solo qualified. The reserves in total spent 4,900 hours last year working for the county. The solo deputies worked an average of 40 hours a month on patrol duties. Umatilla County is 3,200 square miles, broken up into 2 patrol districts. One day a week, on swing shift, there are 4 regular deputies on patrol. That's when shifts happen to overlap. But 6 days a week, there's only 2 deputies on patrol at a time, 1 in each patrol area. It's not unusual to travel 60 to 80, sometimes more miles per call. Solo reserves are additional cars on the road and complement the work of the regular deputies when they are not available for calls. For instance, last week, both our swing shift officers were sick for 3 days, one for another week. So these shifts were vacant until solo reserves filled in. Solo reserves had dedicated many hours of training and patrol duties so they can be qualified to do the same job as regular officers. The 10 other reserves work as second officers in a car, and while they are continuing training to become solo. Reserves are also responsible for the Sheriff's Office Snow Patrol and AT patrols that we do in the county. Reserves are unpaid volunteers. They do this job because they like giving back to the community. They are professionals and have dedicated much of their lives in serving the citizens of the county. Last year, during the week of Roundup, Pendleton Roundup, there were over 85,000 extra people in town. The Sheriff's Office used over 30 officers from outside agencies to complement the local law enforcement at the different venues. Many of these were reserves. Without reserves, we would not have enough officers from the surrounding area to draw from to fill these duties. There's not any reason why reserves should be regarded differently than regular officers when it comes to the definitions of peace officer in the ORS. House Bill 3153 protects reserve officers in performing the duties that regular reserve officers are already currently doing. House Bill 3211 adds reserve officers to the definition of aggravated murder. ORPO has been trying to get this changed for over 10 years, and some groups even longer. It usually comes up after an incident like what happened in Madras in 2010 or in Jefferson County several years ago. ORPO and OPA support House Bill 3153 and 3211. Thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
My name is Don Swift. I am a reserve captain with the City of Redmond Police Department, and I began my law enforcement career in March 24th of 1965 with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, an agency that I retired from after 28 and a half years of service. I spent 5 years with the Deschutes County Sheriff's Office as their training sergeant, and I've spent the last 13 years with the Redmond Police Department as the reserve captain. In 1995, I created the Central Oregon Reserve Law Enforcement Academy program as a part of my master's thesis. It's a regionalized training academy program, and it serves all of the Central Oregon agencies. Now, that's 3 counties and 4 cities. And on occasion, we have Lake County as a participant. The first academy class was 214 hours. And over the next 16 years, that academy now is 434 hours over 8 months. I've graduated over 400 reserve law enforcement officers, that's both from sheriff's offices and police departments. And 70 or 75% of those officers now are full-time, someplace in Oregon, a lot of places, Idaho, Washington, and California. The majority of the remaining Reserve Academy graduates remain as reserves in Central Oregon. House Bill 3153 clarifies the definition of reserve officers who are in fact performing the same and similar tasks as full-time police officers. Among other things, it will allow reserve officers from different jurisdictions to work together more effectively during large-scale community events and emergencies. As an example, a number of years ago, officers from Redmond Police Department and the Bend Police Department assisted the Deschutes County Sheriff's Office with perimeter security during the Black Butte fire. It gives reserve officers protection when responding to assist other officers in jurisdictions outside the city limits. The city of Redmond plays host to the Deschutes County Fairgrounds, and we have hosted any number of events there where we've had assistance from the Sheriff's Office in Deschutes County, from Jefferson County, from Crook County, and from the Bend Police Department. And those events include Deschutes County Fair, as well as two military funerals for personnel killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. House Bill 3211 adds reserve officers to the definition of the aggravated murder statute. Police officers, deputy sheriffs, they already are listed in the definition of aggravated murder. But reserve officers, who are volunteers, they volunteer their time, their energy, and their talents to perform the same duties. They're not. And this corrects that oversight. On May the 20th of 2010, three Madras police officers were the victim of an attempted murder. They were on duty fulfilling their oath of office to protect and defend their community. Sergeant Dennis Snyder, Officer Ryan Catron, and Officer John Young were shot at multiple times by two suspects whose intent was to kill each of the officers. Fortunately, by the grace of God, the officers were not hit or injured. 2 months later, the suspects were apprehended, and the criminal justice system, for charging and conviction purposes, could only recognize the law enforcement status of the two full-time officers, not the reserve officer, John Young. John is a married father with three children. He's a graduate of the 2009 Central Oregon Reserve Academy program. He's one of my students. John's wife, Dawn, has attended our spousal training program that is a part of the academy program. Their son, Thurman, was born during this academy. John volunteered and continues to volunteer his time, energy, and skills as a Madras reserve officer. Doesn't he deserve the same legal protections that his full-time brother and sister police officers and deputy sheriffs in this state? Reserve officers that attend the Reserve Academy program in Central Oregon receive their training very similar to that of the DPSST Basic Police Academy. Our curriculum is modeled after that program, and it focuses on the available resources in Central Oregon. Over 90 instructors work with the reserve candidates, providing them quality training. I know that in other parts of the state that our academy program has been used for the development of regional academies, and that's Clackamas County's Regional Academy and Hood River Regional Academy are both adopting our program. I also know that there are 14 other regional or cooperative reserve academy programs covering Oregon. Once a reserve candidate graduates, they return to their agency and continue field training under the supervision of a field training officer. To progress to solo patrol status, the reserves must prove their skills in continuous training and advance in incremental steps. The reserves are there to support and complement the full-time officers. By department policies, they have no off-duty law enforcement powers and are subject to the same professional standards of conduct as regular officers. I have spent over 45 years of my life as a regular and reserve officer. Reserve officers are volunteers with no pay, and they volunteer to serve all of our communities. They deserve the same protections as regular officers. I urge you to look at these bills and to support them from both the professional and personal side. I thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak with you regarding your bills, and again, respectfully request your support of House Bill 3153 and 3211. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, thank you for having me testify before you today. My name is Corey Medeiros. I'm a Newtonville police officer, reserve police officer. I'm also the program coordinator and the treasurer for the Oregon Association of Reserve Police Officers. I've been with the police department of McMinnville Police Department for 18 years, so a long time. Full-time, my regular job, if you will, I work as an applications programmer on a mainframe with the Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. I've been with that company for about 18 years as well. today I'm here to talk about House Bill 3153 to show my support and also explain how agencies kind of cooperate, especially within our county, and working with each other. One of the examples I'd like to share with you, and maybe you guys all probably recognize, is Oktoberfest. Some of you probably attended Oktoberfest. Mount Angel puts on Oktoberfest sometime in September. Their department has about 10 officers, with four of them being reserve officers. The population for the city is about 3,500. But during Oktoberfest, that population jumps up to 350,000. So you can see what kind of outstanding faces, roadblocks that the police department has to look at. Mount Angel usually asks other departments to borrow, if you will, the reserve officers. So reserve officers from my department usually go and assist Mount Angel Police Department in working and keeping the program, the festivities, the people within the community safe. So we will actually provide support for about 4 days, and we have about 9 officers, and all 9 usually participate. The one thing that I like about my Oktoberfest is that when we're there, we wear our own uniforms. I'm wearing a McMinnville Police Department uniform. People from McMinnville find it pretty neat that they see an officer from their own city helping out another city. It's a great way for us to also help out with community policing. We take advantage of using that opportunity to talk to the people to not only promote our city, but also Mount Angel. And they take a lot of pride in seeing the police officers over there. They really do. So we always get stops like, "You're from McMinnville." It's like, "Yes, I am." So that is a neat thing. That is how our departments all share and help one another. I think that is a very important thing. Another scenario I'd like to share with you is a homicide that happened about 7 months ago in the city of Dundee. Newburgh Dundee Police Department was assisting and was investigating a homicide. The crime scene actually spread over about 3-block radius and actually had 2 separate crime scene areas. For the city of Newburgh Dundee, or the police department for Newburgh Dundee, that was a pretty large area. They needed assistance. Their department is about the same as ours. Asked if reserves could come over and assist. Being a coordinator, they contacted me. I got a hold of all the reserves, whatever I could, and went there to assist them. We assisted them with not only the crime scene security, but also processing of evidence, techniques and skills that we learned within the academy, the MVRT Academy. While we were there, it turns out that some of the people involved were also from McMinnville, one of whom I knew and dealt with on a regular basis. So not only that we were sending officers to help out with processing the crime scene as also security, we were also helping with the investigation with the Newburgh detectives. I just about a month ago helped out with the prosecution of that one subject on behalf of the Newburgh Dundee Police Department. Yamhill County is kind of unique. We have a lot of multi-agency teams, from our drug team to our traffic team. But we also have a cooperation between all the agencies and all the reserve officers, departments, and the sheriff's department, that we also share reserves. So when we have, say, Turkey Ramo or Phil Sheridan days or whatever the case might be, if they need assistance, they're more than welcome to contact our supervisors, our chief, and say, "Hey, can we have your help?" And I think that's what's unique, not only within our county, but counties all across the state. And I think that's what really makes our program unique. Remember now, we're all volunteers just providing our time, free. I have a regular job, but still it's nice to go ahead and help people in our community as well as other communities. And I think that's what's unique about our situation. So I want to thank you for your time. I don't want to take up too much time, but I was also open up to the committee if you guys have any questions for either of us.
Okay. Is there any questions, committee? Thank you all very much for your service. And, Captain, I really appreciate the fact that you took a master's thesis and it didn't just go on a shelf somewhere after that nobody read. You really turned into a very valuable program, and us Oregonians really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Next, I'll call Vern Wells and Rob Bovet.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Baker and Co-Chair Krieger. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to be here and talk to you today about these two bills. I don't want to take a great deal of your time because you've already heard great speakers on this topic. I am here. I'm Vern Wells. I'm the chief from Independence, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs and Police, a past president of that organization. And to just reiterate what you've already heard, reserves take pretty much the same training as our regulars. They work side by side with our regulars, and you know, we expect them to step up and provide protection to our community and to the state. We don't expect them to hold back, and I don't think we as representatives of the state should hold back in protecting them in the times that they need help. I'll tell you something that hasn't come up yet, a unique situation to us, is as we were losing staff, we had the opportunity to hire a lady who was leaving another department. She was having a child and wanted to stay home with her child, so she could no longer work full-time. Great police officer, certified, but we had the opportunity to hire her part-time, but a part-time person under the definition of a police officer is a reserve. So she works on average 20 hours a week for us. She does exactly the same thing the regular officers do. And actually the second call she had on the second day that she worked for us after she had finished her field training was a family disturbance. But as she got there, she was met at the door by a gentleman bearing a knife. She held that guy at gunpoint until the rest of us could get there. And, you know, and I think back on that and think, if that had gone terrible, if she'd have been hurt, why would we want to treat her any differently than we treat an officer in the same situation? So the Chiefs Association would certainly ask for your support in these two bills. We absolutely support them and hope you do as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, Rob Ovette, District Attorney from Lincoln County, on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, likewise, we urge you to support this legislation. Over the past years, I've had the privilege of working directly with our Reserve Academy and ORPO as well, a great bunch of folks dedicated to our community. Like the Chief said, I see no reason why we should treat Reserve officers and full-time officers any differently when it comes to enforcement of the criminal laws and especially when they're victims of those crimes. Furthermore, the jurisdictional issue has been mentioned. In 1973, this legislature dispensed with those jurisdictional borders for our peace officers. We need to do the same for reserve officers. So, again, would urge you to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Next, I'll call Gail Meyer and Andrea Meyer.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker and Krieger, and members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. If the chair approves, I would like to request, I'm going to discuss this with Ms. Meyer, that we do 3153 first and talk about peace officer, and then have both of us speak on that bill, and then move to the other one, because I think topically they're very different, if we could do that. Thank you. As to 3153, that would pick up the definition of incorporate reserve officers into the definition of peace officers. I have two nephews who are in law enforcement. They start out as reserve officers, and I know from their conversations the situations they can find themselves in. So reserve officers really do deserve accolade for being the utmost of a selfless civic servant, because they do put themselves on the line. And I think there's a difference between saying they need to be protected from crimes occurring against them when they're the victim of an assault. I think that's appropriate to be discussing perhaps an amendment to the assault on a public safety officer statute and whatnot. But the bill goes much further than simply giving them protection when they're serving in their capacities. It also gives them a lot of powers. So if you look at House Bill 3153, on line 5, it incorporates a host of statutes within the definition of a peace officer. So as used in ORS 133.005 to .381 and then .410 to 450, those pick up a host of statutes in our criminal code that really authorize some of the most invasive of contacts between law enforcement officers and citizens. So it's not, you know, just citations for traffic arrests, but it's also performing community caretaking functions, which would allow a peace officer to enter a house without a warrant for the purpose of taking care of someone. It would allow a arrests by a peace officer can arrest someone day or night. We've heard testimony that reserve officers are not 24/7. They only work per shift, but the statute would allow them to make arrests day or night. They can arrest someone outside the geographical area of their jurisdiction. They can use physical force. They can use deadly physical force. They can enter a premises in order to arrest someone. And they can also exercise hot pursuit by pursuing someone across the boundaries of Oregon. And the reason that becomes important here is because the bill does not mandate that reserve officers do get the same level of training as police officers and others that go through DPSST. Regulars, as I'm hearing the witnesses before us are referring to them as regulars, when they go through training at and get certified through DPSST, they go through 600 hours of training. Now, what I know from my conversations with DPSST is that there's no statutory mandate or requirement as to the level of training that a reserve officer gets. That's up to the individual agency that could be training them. So it's up to the individual municipal police force or county sheriff to train their reserves and give them the level of training they should so require. Now, some of them are great. Some of them, I'm told, are even exceed what you would get through DPSST, but others are not. And so what the bill does is, by purview of statute, it would say the legislature says you can go forth and use all of these powers of a peace officer irrespective of whether you've received the commensurate level of training to do that. And on the flip side, when something goes wrong, I think the question is this. Right now, if a certified law enforcement officer, police officer or sheriff that goes through DPSST, there's a disciplinary sanctioning provision there. If there's a question as to their mental fitness, whether it's become of some dependency on a prescribed drug or a depression or alcoholism, if there's some issue as to moral turpitude because of some conduct, there is a disciplinary framework in place through DPSST that then assures statewide consistency as to how they are supervising. What this bill would do, again, reserve officers do not come under the jurisdiction of DPSST. And so it's not just an issue of level of training, but it's also an issue of there would be no state oversight of discipline and sanctioning in the event that there could be something wrong. So we do think that there's plenty of cause for pause. Again, if the issue and the concern is that reserve officers should not be the subject of assaults while they're performing their services and their duties, I would agree with that, and that would be a bill of a different nature. That would be an amendment to the specific statutes that forbid that conduct. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, and I also share the concerns that Gail Meyer just expressed. And I understand this is a pretty complicated thing because reserve officers already have been doing a lot of the work, as you've heard testimony, and I appreciate that there's the Central Oregon Academy training, and I'm no doubt convinced that the law enforcement agencies that oversee reserve officers feel in many times an obligation to have the right training and ensure that all those reserve officers, but their companion officers, are safe. But without the statutory requirements for training and funding by DPSST, or however the system needs to be working for training, we are very concerned about this and would actually rather see police officers, I should say, you know, there's a statutory requirement, I believe, for DPSST training. And not only do they do, I think, the 16 weeks, but I know in Portland and probably other jurisdictions, there's a lot more training that happens after that, recognizing that there's a lot of training necessary for officers to be fully equipped to do their job safely and successfully. We would like to see the same requirements in law rather than leaving to the discretion of law enforcement agencies, that there be sufficient training for reserve officers that is uniformly done to ensure that they are also operating under best practices and safe practices. And only after that's been done, I think, should we have the conversation about placing them in the statute. If there's some liability issues or other things during the interim we can deal with, or in amendments with this, I'd rather do that incrementally, but I feel a little bit, excuse the expression, cart before the horse. I want to ensure that there's training. Otherwise, the ACLU has no concerns. Our concerns have always been that when officers have the authority to engage in the activities they can, that they be sufficiently trained. And beyond that, we don't get involved in these issues. But so that's our testimony on that piece as well.
Is there any questions about this, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gail, my question is for you. So I'm looking at here at line 5. So when you quote all the ORSs, you're saying that, in essence, it would give reserve officers the same rights and responsibilities as regular officers. Is that what you're saying? And that is your concern.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and Representative Tomei, yes, they would have the full breadth of authority as all other officers would have in all of its, yeah.
Okay, and if I have one last question. So, and also your concern is that the educational or training response or requirements in each different district are different, and so Portland's, it sounds like, is pretty intensive, but you're saying that other districts that may not be as intensive. Is that correct?
Yes. Co-chairs Krieger and Barker and Representative Tomei, yes, that is it. From my understanding, there's a variation around the state as to the level of training of the reserve officers. Some agencies have no intention of really using their officers in really intricate, sensitive law enforcement functioning. It's mm-hmm. it's more traffic control for 4th of July parades and things of that nature. So it would stand to reason their level of training would be less than what you would get through DPSST. And by purview of the statute, it would give all reserve officers, irrespective of level of training, all the rights to make arrests and enter buildings and exceed jurisdictional boundaries and hot pursuit as those officers that do receive adequate training.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I understood that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I may add one comment to that, I think, and maybe the strategy to distinguish is, you know, there was the definition, I think it was never funded, certified reserve officers, because I think, as Gail just pointed out, there are some reserve officers who are doing photo radar and other things, and that wouldn't seem to require the sufficient level of training that many of the others that you've heard testify really engage in.
Okay, and any other questions? I'm sorry, Council.
And co-chairs, Representative Nolan, to respond to a point that was just passed me. I assume you wanted me to respond on the record. Yes. The scope of the ORS, if you mean in terms of the powers that are being afforded, I do note that there's explicit reference being made in terms of what statutes are being covered to things like community caretaking functions, things like that, which I think does somewhat buttress the testimony of Ms. Meyer that this would be an expansion of the existing understanding of reserve officers. I don't know to what extent they vary that internally. We've heard testimony that I think in some areas they're expected to do some of those things now anyhow, so I think the existence of that power is not necessarily contrary to statute as it stands now. I think there are parts of the state where that's already being done.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Question is for Ms. Meyer. Isn't it the case?
Which one?
sorry.
You can use first name.
Gail Meyer. Isn't it the case that a local jurisdiction, whether it's a city council or a local police chief, such as Troutdale, has the ability to define on their own whether a reserve officer is fully trained and therefore has the commensurate responsibilities, or if they are still in training and they keep them doing other things? This law change doesn't require that untrained people be doing things that they are not trained to do. Is that right?
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chairs, Krieger and Barker, and then Representative Wand. Yes, and if I can loop in your comment in an answer also something Mr. Knott said in response to Representative Nolan. Right now, as I understand it, because I've been staring at the statutes, and right now, as I understand it, it's for local jurisdictions. So, for instance, City of Troutdale, their chief of police, no doubt in consultation with the city council, would make a determination, we need reserves, let's go train these reserves, and we'll have them do X, Y, and Z functions. And those functions are different jurisdiction to jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Some are having them do the full breadth of law enforcement functioning, and others are just more isolated functions. And so what the bill would do, though, is the bill would say, legislatively, from this branch of government, we give any reserve officer the full panoply of authority. So while the city may say you may only do X, Y, and Z, the legislature would say you can do A to Z.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair, but they are limited by their oath that I used to see on about a bi-monthly basis as a city councilor to uphold the ordinances of that city, and they are still subject to the chain of command. So if the police chief of Troutdale says you will not do X, it doesn't matter what's in that statute. They can't do X without violating the chain of command. So really what we're doing is looking at a bill that expands local control and lets our local police stations and police officers and cities have greater breadth of authority to decide what they want their reserve officers to do.
Coaches Barker and Krieger and Representative Wand, where I see the problem lies is if the city of Troutdale wants to say to its reserve officers, you may only do X, Y, and Z, then I would agree with you. They would presumably do X, Y, and Z, and only that. But the legislature, through this bill, would be saying they can do A to Z irrespective of level of training. Irrespective of level of training. And irrespective of statewide oversight as to discipline, if they should exceed the bounds of statute, or if they should become mentally unfit, or if they should engage in conduct warranting discipline or suspension. And right now, we only give the full panoply of peace power authorities to people who have gone through a level of training and who are under the jurisdiction of a statewide agency that oversees their fitness and their compliance. And this would be an exception to that.
Thank you. And I just would point out that in many cases, officers that aren't reserve officers that aren't trained are doing some of these things already.
Yes.
Because they've been trained that level. And the local jurisdictions certainly take into account their liability of sending somebody out who isn't trained. That would be there. And as far as the discipline piece, there's kind of a myth about the Portland Police Bureau that nobody can get fired, which isn't true, but it is quite difficult at times. And I've been there and sat through many of an arbitration, and I can tell you that a reserve officer, a chief waves his magic wand, or a sheriff, and they're gone that quick. And I've had occasion where I've had a problem with a reserve officer, I notified the local authority, that's the end of their reserve career. So thank you, though. You made some very good points on that. Do you want to move to the next one, or you can comment if you want to move on?
Do you have any more?
Thank you.
Thank you. Where are we now? House Bill 3211 would add the definition of reserve officer to the aggravated murder statute. We've passed out two things to you. I had wished that I could have gotten before you today a witness, Jeffrey Ellis. The Oregon Public Defender Services Commission decided we needed to have a Capital Resource Center here in Oregon. And so Jeffrey Ellis is the new director of the Oregon Capital Resource Center. He is an academic, but he's also practiced death penalty defense in about five other states. He could make the point far more eloquently than me. But here's the point. Firstly, let me state OCDLA is opposed to the death penalty in its entirety, so we would be here regardless of what the statute read. But as to broadening the aggravated murder statute piecemeal, we would like the committee to appreciate this fact. Oregon has probably, it's been stated to have the broadest aggravated death penalty statutory scheme of any state in the nation. We have over 33 different circumstances that make a homicide death eligible. That far exceeds the norm, and I am told that it's the broadest in the United States. Part of it is that we have a long list of qualifiers, but then also we incorporate the felony murder statute wholesale, whereas other states like Texas limit which cases and what fact patterns are death eligible and which ones are not. So we do have potentially the broadest of death penalty statutory scheme in the nation. In addition to that, we don't have a procedural governor in our death penalty statutes that would require prosecutors, district attorneys, to exercise discretion as to which cases are death eligible and which ones are not. A fact that is known over on the Senate side, they're looking at a series of bills right now. The state of Washington has twice our population. We have 10 times as many death penalty cases as they do. We have 10 times as many pending cases, 10 times as many death row. And yet Washington exceeds our population by twice as much. And that's because they have a procedural governor in their statute that we do not have. It would require prosecutors at the front end of a case. They have an aggravated murder statute like we do, but they require prosecutors to say, this one in particular deserves the death penalty. What happens here in Oregon is that all of the death, if you charge with aggravated murder, it is by purview of statute death eligible, and then therein rises all of the costs and attendant consequential delays that arise from that. So we submit to this committee that rather than amending and broadening the aggravated murder statute piecemeal, know that the Senate right now is taking a look at our death penalty statute in breadth, in scope, and it's hearing a series of bills in April, and it's asking itself, should there be procedural governors put in place that would narrow and limit the scope of this? And we would submit to this committee that having a more comprehensive review of the death penalty scheme is better than doing something piecemeal. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here to testify. I just want to make the record clear on both House Bill 3211 and House Bill 3153 in regards to the expansion of the aggravated murder law. And I should note before I begin that I have a slight typo in my testimony. It may have some subconscious meaning in it that I spelled capital with an O in the first part. I don't know if there's capital punishment.
But the Senate.
I sit in the same room, so I will certainly correct that for the record. And I testified 10 years ago against this proposal, and we do so again because the ACLU of Oregon does oppose the death penalty, and as such opposes any expansion to it. The momentum actually across the country is to eliminate the death penalty and not expand it in any way. And just last week, the governor of Illinois signed a bill to repeal the death penalty in that state, making it the 16th state to abolish the death penalty in the modern era. And the fourth state in 7 years, New York in 2004, New Jersey in 2007, and then New Mexico in 2009. There are also bills pending in 10 other states to repeal the death penalty, and a number of them have a strong chance of passage. Across the country, attempts to fix the capital system have failed. The ACLU of Oregon opposes the death penalty because we believe it is inconsistent with the underlying values of our democratic system. Its use in this country has been fraught with issues of discrimination against the poor, uneducated, and members of minority communities. And in recent decades, we have discovered it is fraught with innocent issues. Since 1973, over 139 people have been released from death row because of innocence. There have been death row exonerations in 26 states, the majority of those occurring in the last 10 years. 17 of the Innocence Project's 266 post-conviction DNA exonerees were sentenced to death when their innocence was established solely because there was DNA testing now available. Statistics show that states with the death penalty continue to have the highest rates of violence and violent crime. In a 2009 national survey of 500 randomly selected police chiefs, most of them ranked capital punishment last as the most important, as what is most important for reducing violent crime, and said it was the least efficient use of taxpayers' money. They ranked increasing the number of police officers, reducing drug abuse, and creating a better economy with more jobs higher than the death penalty as the best way to reduce violence. For all these reasons, the ACLU urges you not to proceed forward with either House Bill 3211 or the provision in House Bill 3153 that expands the aggravated murder statute. Thank you.
Thank you. And some of the innocence numbers were people or cases were thrown up on technical rather than actual factual innocence issues. Not all of them. I agree with you on that. And the other thing, well, Washington, I think the real thing that slows down their death penalty case up there is they require the counties to pick up the funding. And that's why they have, a lot less. And I know the Senate is looking at several things. We kind of, on this side of the bill, well, we're on their side today, but some of us, I won't speak for anybody else, I think, that it's kind of like hospice. The Senate's kind of like hospice where good bills go to die sometimes. So,
Chair Barker, I'm happy to look into the innocence. I got this specifically in a question today to the Innocence Project, and it was over 139 people because of innocence. I'm happy to look at that data. Of course, I never look at anything as technical. It may be procedural errors, but significant. But regardless if it's one person, and I know you agree with that, if it's one innocent person, it's one person too many.
Yeah. Any other questions of the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your
thank
time.
Thank you.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3211. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3153. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2705.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2705 modifies ORS 163208 and 166070 pertaining respectively to the crimes of assaulting a public safety officer and aggravated harassment. For both of these crimes, the definition of an eligible actor would be expanded to include persons authorized to issue citations for violations of parking laws.
Hey, thank you. James Aiken, Gary Steiner, and Joan Hampton. Dalton McHale can come up as well if you want to just drag another chair up, if there's four of you. And please go ahead in any order, just identify yourself for the record.
My name is James Aiken, citizen, lifelong resident of Salem, Oregon, former City of Salem Parking Enforcement Officer, former chair of the Bay Right Neighborhood Association, South Salem.
Okay, go ahead. If you have your testimony, go ahead.
Okay. I'm here in support. I retired from parking from an injury just to be a support to this bill. The reason I support it is past experience as a parking officer. I find that it's important that everybody get treated equally. When a uniform officer is in the conduct of his profession, should be treated equally as if he is a police officer. I've had two cars attempt to run me over, both in essence of trying to elude being cited. They were followed up by our office. And our parking officers occasionally get verbal abuse, and sometimes it's in fun, but sometimes it's very serious, and I've had a couple people in my face. We are observe and report officers. We don't go out and try to create trouble. We do observe, we do follow. Been commended for a couple situations where we did follow up, observe the event, follow the person until the police came on scene. But at this point, I'm retired. I'm a citizen. I'm here because these folks need the support of the citizens, and by knowing that they are treated the same as a rare public safety officer gives a better chance for respect for the organization. I used to work with Officer Steiner here, who will give you more of the conduct of what the parking officer does. But again, I want to make sure that you understand that parking officers don't go out and try to find trouble. It usually finds us. And we're of observed report capacity by policy procedure. If we go beyond that, we're disciplined.
Okay, thank you very much.
Dear Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for allowing us to be able to voice our concern today. My name is Gary B. Steiner, and I'm here to encourage you to approve House Bill 2705. For over 25 years, I've been employed as a City of Salem Parking Enforcement Officer. During this time, my life and the lives of my fellow parking officers have been threatened repeatedly just in the course of doing our jobs. My job, or our jobs, have a large range of responsibilities. Some of those responsibilities include assisting people find businesses, places to park, and even in some cases, even help them find their vehicle. These kinds of responsibilities are primarily public relations and education oriented. However, my job also entails other responsibilities, which are found in the other range of the spectrum. Those responsible including having to enforce ordinances of the City of Salem, revised codes of vehicles and traffic, Chapter 102. Sometimes there are times when I give a simple verbal warning or issue a courtesy notice that make a citizen aware of about a parking violation or what we call an infraction. Other times my investigation leads to me to issue a downtown parking district information notice, which employs residents, employees, or students of the downtown area about the Salem downtown parking district ordinance. Those fines can be assessed as to as much as $250 per violation. Other times, individuals accumulate unpaid parking tickets, and it can be leading to my having to issue a parking bails notice for that amount to which they owe. It could also wind up having me caused to immobilize their vehicle. In some cases, those vehicles have to be towed in an effort to be able to get those parking bails paid. In other cases, when public safety is threatened, my job is to tow vehicles to ensure that public safety has been secured. During emergencies, I've had to block streets off and to ward off drivers from entering the dangerous flooded areas. Parking officers have had our lives threatened even in the process of writing tickets to vehicles over issuing simple expired meter or overtime violations. A few years ago, one officer was assaulted, and all he did was ask the driver let the driver know that his meter was expired in the hopes of getting compliance. The driver got out of his car, picked up the officer, threw him down, and proceeded to beat on him and then drove away. Though a police officer was called and medical help came on the scene, the driver was not charged for this particular assault. Though I have not been physically abused, I have been verbally abused and stalked just in the course of walking my beat or driving in my patrol vehicle. I've had no knives pulled on me, and many times I've had the need to call for a backup, and some of those times it was necessary to call the Salem Police Department to assist. There is an attitude in our society that parking officers do not deserve the respect that the police officers have. The statements, "You're just a meter maid. I don't have to pay attention to you. You're just a wannabe cop. Get out of my way or I'll run you over." Those individuals who choose to have that frame of mind have no regard for the ordinances, nor the parking officers who enforce them. They carry the quote-unquote no consequences attitude, indicating that there will be no consequence for them if they disobey a simple ordinance. As it stands now, there isn't sufficient consequences for parking violator abuses. I come before you today on behalf of my fellow parking officers to help create a change in that attitude.
a change that would reflect and bring about more respect. But I'm also coming before you today as a family man. I am a husband, father, a grandfather, and even a great-grandfather. I have a meaningful and purpose-driven life, just like those who are in this room today. Every person deserves to be shown dignity. Every person has incredible value and deserves to be shown dignity and respect, even if that officer happens to be a parking enforcement officer. I thank you for this opportunity, and I urge you to consider the attitude and the frame of mind, the consequences of what's been done, in the hopes of being able to change that. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nolan McCrill. I'm the Division Manager of Parking Enforcement in the City of Portland. I've submitted a written testimony for you, and I'll just be really brief on
some of the things within it.
And I just want you to know that I support the bill to add the protection for parking officers throughout the state who issue citations. It's a very hard job. People are abusive to them verbally. And in the past 4 years, I've seen within Portland citizens becoming more aggressive toward our parking officers, requiring police to come. But unfortunately, the police have minimal abilities because it's only a misdemeanor to assault a parking enforcement officer. So the abilities for the police are limited within some of the things that are done to parking officers. I've had officers who have been hit and thrown to the ground, pushed against buildings, one with a come after them and broke their arm with a metal bar. It is serious, and the protection that they have, and people do know that this is a minimal crime, if at all, they are prosecuted. And they tell other people about those kinds of circumstances, which that view does not go across as being tough on any kind of abuse toward an officer. I'd just like to just let you know that this bill would put the officers within the same level as a peace officer, a firefighter, a corrections officer. And I just wanted to ask for your support for the protection for the parking officers throughout the state and in Portland. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hammond.
Thank you.
I have one more thing. I also do have a letter of support from Multnomah County District Attorney that's been sent to you also.
Yes, thank you.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, I am Joanne Hampton, a parking code enforcement officer for the City of Portland's Bureau of Transportation. I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before your committee on House Bill 2705. Which would provide me additional protections by classifying assault against parking enforcement officers as a felony, as currently provided by law for peace officers, correction officers, youth correction officers, parole and probation officers, animal control officers, firefighters, or staff members. Today I'd like to talk to you about what my job entails and an incident that happened to a fellow officer and how this bill will give me and my fellow officers the support we need to deal with this ever-increasing problem. First, let me tell you a little about my job. I am a scooter officer and patrol an assigned beat within the city of limits of Portland. I enforce a variety of parking regulations, such as blocking fire hydrants, driveways, crosswalks, and traffic hazards. But I primarily issue citations for overtime parking in time zones. I usually issue between 30 and 50 citations daily, and encounters with people who receive a citation do occasionally occur. Most of these are verbal, and the public relations training that I've received through my employer and years of experience enable me to calm these by providing clear information on the reason for the citation was issued. However, in spite of my efforts, my training, and understanding of why people get upset, there have been times where these incidents have escalated into physical and frightening assaults. Secondly, I would like to share a specific incident that a fellow officer encountered while patrolling a bike beat in Northwest Portland. A man approached her from behind and spit on her. After reporting the incident to our radio dispatcher, a police officer responded and apprehended the assailant several blocks from the incident. The police officer spoke with him and then subsequently put him in the back of his police car. He told our parking enforcement officer that although they were familiar with this particular individual from other behavior requiring police intervention, there was nothing they could really do but release him. A few weeks later, this same officer encountered the same individual who threatened her and yelled obscenities at her. On the third encounter with this same person, he spit on her again. This man had physically assaulted another officer and spit in the face of an officer who needed to seek medical care because of the real fear of contamination. Had the protection been in place that this bill entitles, a higher level of priority would have been available for prosecuting this individual at the first offense. Finally, let me explain how this bill would reassure me that my job is taken seriously and given the same protection as others already included within this bill. I will feel confident that if a person does go beyond the limits of routine encounter, and if I am injured, I will know that the police will have the ability to arrest and detain this individual. More importantly, I will know that all of you understand the dangers we face in our jobs and have taken the necessary steps to protect civil servants that work with the public every day. I am not expecting this to be used as a tool for the mundane happenings that go along with being a parking enforcement officer. Ideally, we'd never even have to need this protection. But my fellow officers and I are asking for the peace of mind that when something does happen, we are protected and a foundation for the violation has been established. Thank you for this opportunity to address this issue, and we respectfully ask for your support in establishing the protections within this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Officer Steiner.
Yes, Representative Hicks.
Thank you for coming here today and sharing your experiences. I wanted to revisit the story that you told us about and also in your written testimony about the officer who was thrown on the ground and beaten up but was not charged with apparently anything. And I wonder, is there more background you could provide us on that? It sounds like from those facts, an assault occurred under the existing law. Why was the person not charged? Do you have any insight on that?
This individual had multiple other complications with the city of Salem, and this was a lesser of the offense, and the plea bargain was made, and they agreed to dismiss others in order to cite and allow other measures to be able to take care of. So it didn't rank up there as a crime in lieu of other instances that this particular individual committed. You're welcome.
Representative Olson, please.
I didn't hear the, thanks, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear the early testimony, but did you describe what type of vehicles you're in? Are they marked? Are your uniform that you're displaying, that type of description for this?
Representative Olson, we are in all marked uniforms, some of which is my liner, but we all have marked outfits, my jacket, I have a radio, and I drive a marked parking services vehicle, and we have had in the past Cushmans, went to Go4s, and Tridents, and then now we drive four door sedans and Ford Focuses. All of them have marked community services or now parking services on the vehicle. That particular situation had to do with the expired meter, in which the officer happened to observe the meter was expired, the person was in the vehicle, and the officer approached the individual
got him to roll the window down so he could communicate with them, and just to let him know that his meter was expired. The individual got out of his car and proceeded to physically abuse the officer and throwing him to ground, and then left the scene. And the officer, police officer, didn't arrive on time to be able to take care of it because it was a quince scenario, but it was a very hurtful scenario. And medical help was called, and later on, the driver's license of the vehicle was reported, and the police department did follow up.
Okay, that's more of what I needed to know, but thanks.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2705. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3251.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3251 would prohibit a public body from disclosing the audio or video records of an internal investigation interview of a public safety officer, except for certain enumerated exceptions. Now, in the introduction version of the bill, that's except to law enforcement for the purposes of the investigation or to an attorney representing a public safety officer who is the subject of the investigation. I am in possession, I hope you are in possession as well or have access to, two draft amendments, both of which delete lines 10 through 12, which is the exception, replace it with language, first of all, allowing release to a law enforcement unit for the purposes of the investigation, an attorney representing the public safety officer who is the subject of the investigation, or DPSST. That's the dash one. Dash two adds to that a subsection four. The disclosure of records under subsection three of this section does not make the records subject to further disclosure.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Brian DeLeishman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. With me is Jeff Leedy, who represents the Oregon State Police Officers Association, also one of my clients, and Gerald Gerritsen, representing both associations. I know it's been a long day. We'll attempt to be very brief, and I'll ask Jeff to describe the specific circumstance that brought us to this bill. But you have heard from Council that there is at least two sets of amendments. I've informed both the co-chairs and the council that there is likely to be additional amendments. I've been approached by both the criminal defense attorneys, and I'm aware also that the District Attorneys Association is interested in an amendment. It's not our intent to block the release of that information or those recordings to their lawful use. It is only our intent to block the audio or video recordings to go out to the press that then result in the situation in which I'll have Jeff describe. And with that, I'll end my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Jeff Leedy. I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I'm also a senior trooper with the Oregon State Police for over 24 years. In my tenure with the Oregon State Police Officers Association as their president, I sat next to many police officers and troopers that were involved in critical incidents, officer-involved shootings, where they were being interviewed in the course of the investigation of that shooting. I've also been an investigator with the Oregon State Police, and I know how important it is to get a record of and a transcript of testimony. However, not too many years ago, there was a police officer who was interviewed after a police officer-involved shooting in which a suspect was shot and killed, who was interviewed, and it was videotaped. The district attorney's office released that videotape shortly after the shooting, and I can tell you from personal experience, it's a very traumatic incident and very emotional as you have to relive that shooting. And it's not unusual. Police officers do cry. They break down. It's a terrible circumstance to have to relive that and then be, in some cases, be treated like a suspect. It's not the intention of the police officers investigating to do that, but it just feels that way. Shortly after this the videotape was released, it was on the news, and they actually had, for lack of a better term, Officer Leedy ringtones that you could download to your phone. The only way that we can prevent that, and we can, is by refusing an audio or videotaped interview. And that is what we have done since then. Unless I can get assurance from the district attorney that this won't be released, it's our advice to our members not to give an audio or videotaped interview. And that's where we're at now. I see the importance of being able to do that and in part of the investigation, but we're not willing to risk having Trooper Jeff Leedy ringtones that you can download.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, my name is Darrell Gerritsen. I'm attorney for the Oregon State Police Officers Association and also attorney for the Oregon Council of Police Associations. I've sat through numerous interviews of officers involved in the use of deadly force. I would say probably around 200. No police officer wants to take another human life. And what happens generally when the officer is finally giving that statement, the emotional impact of what has happened to them comes forward, and it is not unusual for the officer to break down, to cry, because it's a human tragedy. I think you've probably seen the statistics that approximately 80% of officer-involved shootings are suicide by cop. They are, in fact, some despondent individual that can't take their own life and makes the police officer shoot them. It is very difficult for the police officer. It's compounded, however, when that emotional, distraught tape ends up on the internet. And the one problem we have in today's information age is that voice recordings, video recordings now can be picked up and disseminated, and they never die. And we did have a situation where they were selling this officer's ringtones of this officer crying on the internet. The remedy has been simply to refuse to allow a video or audio recording, because these are all voluntary statements. None of these officers are ever ordered to give a statement. The problem in any investigation, however, is that if somebody's having to write handwritten notes of an interview, one, the interview takes 3 or 4 times longer, and second, you don't get the full flavor of what occurred. What we've done, for instance, in Marion County was where the videotape was released, is the DA's office actually hires a court reporter so there can be a transcript so you can get an accurate interview. But that's an added expense to the public. This bill does not prohibit the content of the interview from being released as a public record. All it does is keeps the officer's voice and image from becoming a public record, basically, from being disseminated out in the internet, from being played over and over again on the news media, to basically reduce the trauma to the officer. Because certainly if you were interviewed and you broke down and you were crying, would you want to see yourself on the TV news the next day? Would you want to hear yourself on the TV news next day? Would you want it out on the internet? And the answer is no. So in order to expedite these investigations and still have a complete and accurate record, the associations would like to be able to have these interviews tape recorded so we do have an accurate record, but to protect the officer's personal privacy.
Questions?
Co-chairs, I do have one additional that I failed to mention. I was also approached by the City of Portland, and I think some of the other cities or counties may have the same concern, in which they have a citizens review panel of police agency and whether or not they would have access. And our answer is yes. Again, this is just to try and bar the release out to the media, and not the again the transcript, but the audio or video.
Okay, Representative Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have a question of Aaron here really quick. I want to clarify subsection 1, sub B there on the public body piece right there. We're talking specifically government.
That's correct.
Is what we're talking about. So it would be respectively maybe the state, the city, or the county agencies, whichever is involved. So if you have a situation where, let's say, a TV station or somebody's walking through and just grabs that interview by some off the cuff, I mean, there's nothing that we can do with that.
co-chairs, Representative Wilson, if I understand that portion of your question correctly, sort of, say a TV station comes across this accidentally, would the statute provide some sort of a remedy to compel them to return it or not to broadcast it? I don't believe so. What my understanding is that the state of the law now, the Court of Appeals has made it fairly clear that public records requests can and do include this kind of information. So the Oregonian or a news station will just ask for it, and at this point, district attorney's offices turn it over as a matter of course. So I think that's what this is trying to prevent. An accidental leak, I think, would still be an issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chairs, one additional. I'm thinking while I'm here, but there may be some other legitimate uses, including the Attorney General's office may want to be able to have this, and we're more than willing to work with all the parties, and including counsel, to figure out how to block what we're trying to get blocked, but at the same time having all the legal and authorized uses available. Thank you.
Thank you. Marilyn Rantz, David Berenberg, and Paul Snyder, please. Go in any order. If you want to kick it off, it'll be fine. David, you, Marilyn.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. You do have my written testimony. Additionally, the individuals who testified before I did identified the specific concern of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And I would just like to briefly add that the exception that our department sought is consistent with other exceptions to public record exemptions for the investigations that the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training needs to conduct. And when we identified our concern to the bill's proponents, they were most amenable and very cooperative. We've been working on the amendment language. If you have any questions about our agency's role or the investigations, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Dave Berenberg from the City of Portland, and members of the committee, I should say, and I'll be very brief, too, is that the concerns that we raised with Mr. DeLashmet and that he spoke of in terms of our ability to have our citizen review process have access to the records is one that we feel important to be included, and we, too, are thankful for the receptiveness of the measure's proponents to working with us to resolve that issue. Thank you, Mr.
Great, thank you. Mr. Snyder?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And from the description of both the amendments and the proposed amendments, I suspect all our issues will have been addressed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions to this panel? Thank you, panel. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3251. Open a work session on House Bill 2682. Well, if she isn't here yet, I won't close that briefly. Open House Bill work session on House Bill 2696.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2696 adds nonprofit corporations to the definition of commercial seller for the purpose of selling scrap metal to scrap metal businesses, requires nonprofit corporations to receive payment by check, and authorizes scrap metal businesses to release a check directly to an individual or nonprofit corporation if they have the written approval of the relevant law enforcement agency possessing jurisdiction over the business.
Thank you. Any questions, committee?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2696 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2696 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Wolf.
Aye.
Representative Schaffer.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wan.
Aye.
Representative Blumen.
Aye.
Co-chair. Co-vice chair.
Aye.
Co-vice chair Garrett.
Excused.
Co-chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries, and I'll ask our scrap metal expert, Representative Olson, to carry that for us.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll go ahead and do 3021. Yeah, if you want to. We'll open up work session on House Bill 3021.
And thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 3021 makes modifications to the Department of Justice's Crime Victim Compensation Program. It makes a number of grammatical and substantive changes. The most significant are as follows. It allows victims to apply for compensation within 1 year of the date of injury instead of the current time limit of 6 months. It modifies language regarding counseling benefits available to a victim if an offender is going through the post-conviction processes to make the benefits more accessible to victims. And it clarifies that the amount which can be distributed to a victim under this section is capped at $20,000. Proponent, there have been dash one and dash two amendments submitted. There is a representative here to discuss the contents of that amendment if necessary. Proponents, Department of Justice, are only urging the incorporation of the Dash 2 amendment. Shannon, do you want to outline the Dash 2? Just briefly.
Just explain the Dash 2 for us, please.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Shannon Savelle from the Department of Justice. Did you just want me to address the Dash 2s?
Yeah, just...
Okay. When we provided testimony, we were providing testimony on 3021 with the Dash 1. And all that did was provide that there was some flexibility if a victim could demonstrate that they had a catastrophic injury, that they would be able to apply for the full benefit amount, which is up to $47,000. That was an amendment that we worked on with in the crime victims groups. When that was drafted, an additional statute got added in that covered funeral benefits, which is very different. I mean, there's, I'm sure, an argument to be made that if you've died, you've had a catastrophic injury. However, that changes the type of benefit that we'd be providing, and that was not the intention, and that's the change in the Dash 2.
Is there any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 3021.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 2s into House Bill 3021. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3021 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3021 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shockley.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Anybody have any desire to carry that one? I'll be the carrier. And, okay. Next, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2682.
Chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2682 increases the amount of wages in state statute that are exempt from garnishment in line with the federal law. It just lines up the two numbers. It has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral, and it was previously heard on the 1st of March.
Discussion.
Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2682 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2682 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shawson.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. That one would be good for the consent calendar. Any objection to that going on the consent calendar?
That's fine.
We'll put that on the consent calendar. Thank you. Any further business come before the committee? Adjourned.